Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for the weekend. And joining us today is Professor Mike Tapia. Dr. Tapia is a professor of criminology, criminal science, criminal justice at New Mexico State University. He grew up here in the El Paso area, but he's written a book, Gangs of the El Paso Juarez Borderland. Mike, thank you so much for being with us.
Hi, Louis. Glad to be on the show.
Thank you. Now, from what I understand, before we started the interview, you grew up here. Tell us a little bit about your growing up here.
Yeah, I grew up in the Lower Valley community called Isleta. And as most of your listeners will know, it's a very historic, you know, community. And it's a high poverty community. So that, you know, that being the context for, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, as I was, you know, coming into in high school, you know, that was really kind of the high point of gang activity, not only in El Paso, but across the country. That was the height of violence. 1993 marks, you know, like the most violent period in recent history. And of course, gangs had a lot to do, you know, with that, right?
And why is that, Mike, that it was the most violent, that particular era?
That's the $1,000 question. You know, that's an issue that gets debated in my field, you know, by criminologists ever since that happened, you know. And there's all kinds of theories, even a lot of pop science on that and stuff, but it probably had to do with some kind of, you know, demographic shift, you know, the coming of age of a bunch of kids in that high delinquency, those age groups, you know, 11 to 25 or whatever. And that since has shrunk, you know, as a proportion of the population. So, yeah, it's just a widespread pattern that we see across the country. And like I said, El Paso was not immune to that.
As you mentioned, you grew up in Isleta in a high poverty area. When you were younger, when you were attending perhaps even middle school and high school, were you involved in a gang or were you pressured to be part of one?
No. It's, you know, it didn't really work that way. I think as I write in the book, kind of in afterthoughts, I think like towards the end of the book, in reflecting on what this might mean, you know, like what, you know, so are gangs, are kids chosen to be into gangs? Do they gravitate, you know, naturally? And it's a combination of all that. You know, some kids are like misfortunate enough to be, you know, just marginalized and displaced just enough, or to have it run in their family. You know, it especially amongst Chicano gangs, you know, it tends to be like a intergenerational, traditional type of thing having to do with you know, pride for your barrio, your particular, you know, micro locality where you grew up and its boundaries and stuff like that. So I didn't personally have, you know, that kind of history. And so, I played baseball for Isleta and, you know, just did other activities. But it was in our midst, you know. I mean, your buddies were involved, no matter who they were, if they were, you know, fellow athletes or whatever. It was just, you know, especially at that time frame, 90s, it was a big craze that even so-called good kids were getting swept up in it. But I was lucky enough to, you know, never really go that way.
Some people have said that perhaps, you know, if you belong to the band, if you belong to the choir, if you belong to a certain other group in high school, that can legally be called a gang.
Not if it doesn't include delinquency, and especially violence and, you know, other forms of serious delinquency. That's the qualifier. That's what you need to have the definition.
We're visiting with Professor Mike Tapia. He has written the book, Gangs of the El Paso Juarez Borderland. As you discussed earlier about some people that runs in their families, I'm glad you brought that up, because I remember, gosh, this was a few years back, I was teaching a speech class, and one of the presentations that was done was on gangs, and some of the students had pictures of the little children, maybe 4-5 year old, posing, doing their gang sign.
Yeah, it is a very powerful socializing tradition, you know, and I do also have guest speakers, you know, gang detectives and stuff come to my classes here at NMSU. And yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. And some people will, you know, consider that a very sad picture, you know, to see a 3-year-old all decked out in red and throwing a gang sign and stuff like that. And, you know, I mean, it comes from just a lack of education in terms of what's good for kids, and probably just a personal pride in having that gangster or, you know, criminal identity. You know, it's just part of what some families are proud of.
Is this something that, you know, we've seen movies, we've watched programs, read stories, where if you are in a gang, there's no way you can get out? Is that a myth?
Yeah, it's a total misconception. There are so many ways out of a gang, and none of it is really systematic or anything. Of course, that whole narrative doesn't come from nowhere, right? I mean, there is and was some truth to that in certain contexts, like prison gangs and stuff like that. But even in those very extreme forms of the subculture, there's new research out that is showing that even there are ways out of the gang. You know, the prison has exit programs, and people, you know, who want to get out, they go into protective custody. And so I was on a gang panel on a presentation with a panel of speakers, well-noted speakers that criminal justice at UTEP brought in April. And one of the presenters there, this colleague named David Pyrus, that's the kind of work he presented, and it was an eye-opener. I think a lot of people always considered that, you know, blood in, blood out, and all those, you know, adages and stuff. And so if it's not even true at that level anymore, you know, for prison gangs, then, you know, even less so down the hierarchy, you know, especially when it gets to kids stuff and middle school. I mean, if your family moves across town or whatever, you know, you're not, maybe not with social media, there's a little, you know, you can hold on to those old links a little better, but traditionally, nah, you know, you move somewhere else or whatever, and you lose your gang affiliation. And if you're so inclined, you'll probably join a new gang in the new neighborhood, right?
Let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned the conference that took place here last April, and I believe one of the presenters, and it might have been who you just mentioned, David, but I can't remember. He had a book, and he talked a little bit about how religion also played a big part in gangs and out of gangs.
Uh-huh. That's the work of Rob Duran.
Yes, that's him.
Yeah. Rob Duran, he used to be here. I guess you could say I essentially replaced him here at NMSU as the resident gang scholar. So he's an old friend and great colleague. And so, yeah, it just so happens that we both did research on the borderland, you know, because he was here and he collected a lot of data, and he eventually wrote a book about miracles and paradoxes and stuff. And yes, he attributes a lot of like what we don't see in terms of violence here on the borderland to our, you know, strong sense of a Chicano and Mexicano religiosity. And then the paradox part of his book is like, kind of like my work, this is where our work overlaps, is that the borderland is so rich in its history of gang developments and deeply entrenched, you know, just gang sort of environments and milieu here, yet it doesn't translate into high levels of violence. You know, as probably most of your listeners already know, El Paso is always touted as being one of the safest cities of its size in the United States. And so, yeah, that's another like real huge misconception about gangs and what they're about and the types of things that they engage in. Of course, you take it across to Juarez, and that's a whole other ball of wax. But on this side of the border, you know, it's not really like that. And that holds true of all major like U.S. border cities. If you go to Tijuana and San Diego, San Diego's a lot like El Paso, and Tijuana's a lot like Juarez. And so on and so forth, all the way down Laredo, Matamoros, you name it. You know, that's the pattern. So, yeah, there's a lot to learn there about violence and gangs and stuff.
This book, Mike, that you penned, Gangs of the El Paso Juarez Borderland, it pretty much gives a history of the last 100 years, and it involves a lot of different areas in our area, which I want to talk about in just a minute. But first of all, people think, wait a minute, gangs for the last 100 years, and then somebody else will bring up, well, you know, the Old West, there were gangs too that, you know, rode in and out of town, or perhaps someone there in the town who ran the town. Tell us a little bit about when you started working on this book to talk about the 100-year history. Where did you begin as far as research?
In terms of the timeline, you know, you can find in the archives documentation of the thing we know today as gangs, you know, like street gangs or whatever, in the El Paso area, like around the late teens or the mid-teens. And, of course, as you mentioned, and like where this, you know, where our discussion started, you know, gangs can be writ large, you know, they can be conceived of as, you know, under a very broad, you know, conceptualization, right? Like you said, you know, you could consider Pancho Villa and, or, you know, like bootleggers and rustlers and, you know, Old West type figures as gangs. And so sure enough, yeah, they, you could consider it that. But in terms of the urban inner city youth delinquency thing, I think it becomes kind of a social problem. You know, you start seeing it in the news around, yeah, like the late teens and early 20s. So that's about where the timeline starts in the book. And then just, you know, getting to other chapters, as you mentioned, it goes throughout the region, highlight, the book highlights different communities, you know, as we go up basically from Juarez to El Paso to Anthony to Sunland Park, Chaparral, and all the way up here to Las Cruces, and just kind of highlights, you know, the histories of all those different communities, gang-wise, that is.
So let's go over a little bit throughout this book. You begin, of course, with an introduction. You kind of tell us more or less what you're going to cover and what this book is about. But chapter one starts with the 1920s to, I think it's the 1960s. If you wouldn't mind kind of taking us through that.
Yeah, that's a super interesting, you know, era in this whole gang stuff, because it, you know, it starts off innocently enough, you know, the types of delinquency that you're reading about in the newspapers is pretty benign stuff, you know, like I said, just kind of street corner, mischievous, you know, unsupervised youth milling about, congregating and stuffing and getting into different things. Some of the stories are even funny that you read about, you know, the things that they used to do. But, yeah, as it goes through time, it starts to become a little more serious and insidious. Now, there are little specks of really serious things happening amongst those boys, you know, that are from Segundo Barrio and the very traditional hotspots for gang activity in El Paso. You know, there were murders. There were, you know, gangland murders up close and personal, stabbings, and, you know, so it was gangs have never fully been completely, like, innocent, you know. But, of course, in that era, it was just a different time, and, you know, it, the way you attacked somebody or, you know, had a confrontation was different than it became in the 70s, 80s, 90s, you know, where the weaponry changed and stuff. So that's, you know, that's one way that we've seen it change. Because when you think about gangs, you know, usually equate it to serious delinquency, drug use, you know, violence and stuff. And that, you know, became truer with every passing decade.
You talked earlier about misconceptions and stereotypes, and perhaps two of the words that show up when people are talking about gangs is pachuco or a cholo. And they automatically think if you're either one of those, then you belong to a gang.
Yeah. That's also a debate, I would say, amongst, like, Latino culture scholars and persons like myself, Latino criminologists. You know, to what extent is it just a subculture, you know, having a lot to do with style and dress and attitude and all that? And at what point does it become, you know, a delinquent type formation? And who can deny that there's lots of overlap there, you know, between the two subcultures? But there are folks that will staunchly, you know, defend the point that, no, it's just a form of social resistance, like, you know, where the pachuco thing emerged. And the beauty of this, you know, discussion, putting this discussion into the El Paso Juarez context, is that this region is undeniably the birthplace of that sort of thing, you know, and then it kind of took off, the style and subculture kind of took off nationwide. It sort of spread from here to L.A. and then, you know, east to San Antonio. And so, like, kind of the whole Southwest, you know, Tucson has a huge pachuco, you know, like, tradition. And then cholo is just another manifestation, like a more modern manifestation. And that is probably more defensively, like, delinquent. And that's where it starts to get a little more, like, I guess you could say, criminally embedded than what the pachuco was. And just to note, like, the pachuco dress and style is really, like, coming back, you know, for enthusiasts, culture enthusiasts now who form clubs and have, dress up, pinup contests, you know, guys and gals, like at car shows, like the big one at Lincoln, you know, under the freeway there in central El Paso. So there's a resurgence of, you know, interest in that whole thing. And so now those folks will even more staunchly defend, hey, we're not criminals or anything. We're like architects and, you know, we just love this style. So yeah, there's a lot to say about that topic.
One of the pictures that you present in your book is that of Germán Valdés, very famous actor, Mexican actor, but he's dressed as a pachuco.
Yeah, Germán Valdés, you know, the classic Mexicano actor, fronterizo. You know, he grew up a good part of his youth here in Juárez. And so he embodied that character, if you will, or that personaje here on the border on the silver screen. And I think people just fell in love with that, especially our locals. You know, there's always been kind of a soft spot in El Paso and Juárez, Juarenses, you know, hearts for that type of personaje and, you know, giving it a lot of cariño. And so that's another reason why you don't necessarily, you know, equate that, you know, the pachuco style to, you know, some type of sinister, you know, delinquent or criminal person, you know. So there's a lot of history there.
One of the other pictures that caught my attention in your book, and I think it's the same chapter where you're addressing early barrio gangs, but there's a picture there of some boys from Segundo Barrio, and they're all atop some burros or mules.
Yeah, that was a great photo that I found in the archives at the Central Library downtown. I think it was the Otis Altman collection, and so it's attributed there. But yeah, that was, you know, that if you look at those boys and just see the era, I think 1910 you mentioned, you know, they look like Spanky and Alfalfa, you know, but like a rougher version. You know, it's like a real life version of the little rascals riding on burros, but you could just see they were a group of serious kids, you know, just the gaze in their eyes and stuff. And somebody just snapped that photo. But, you know, yeah, probably a little, you know, early, you know, version of a barrio gang that who got around on burros for all we know. And then it could, you know, it could be way off, you know, it could just be. But I thought that was a great photo to capture.
We're visiting with Professor Mike Tapia. Mike has written the book Gangs of the El Paso Juárez Borderland. He is a professor of criminology at New Mexico State University. As we move up a little bit north, as I mentioned, you cover just about everything in these in this book. But then we start going towards Las Cruces, but we make a kind of a brief pause, although this is in Chapter 3, after Las Cruces, but we pause and you talk a little bit about Anthony and Anapra, Sunland Park, all those areas.
Oh, this for me was the most fascinating part of the book in terms of discovery, you know, because you go into those small communities and, you know, like you said, are kind of traversing, you know, the landscape there. They're, you know, like if you just look at Sunland Park, you know, it's in the tri-state or tri-international area, you know, the corner between Nuevo Mexico, Texas, and Mexico, or, you know, Western Juarez. And, it's like, you know, literally and symbolically kind of the crossroads, you know, in terms of networks and how families, you know, have connections both, you know, north and south of there. And to the extent that gang networks are embedded within normative networks, you know, family, work, you know, just a practicality, crossing the border, which used to be a lot more fluid of a process than it is today, man, those communities got influenced from all directions in terms of how their gang and delinquent subculture unraveled, right, or developed. And so it was just fascinating to see how far back little community gangs, street corner gangs went into those communities. It was surprising because I didn't expect really to find much there. But as you think about it more, that's the perfect place, you know, to see, you know, crisscrossing networks across the region. And that, of course, you know, holds as true for delinquent groups as it does for just regular populations.
So tell us, what impact do these gangs that you research in the Anthony, Sunland Park, La Union, wherever, all these small towns, Canotillo, what impact does Las Cruces and El Paso have, and Juárez, on these gangs?
The reciprocal, you know, impacts, right? Because the subculture seems to bleed over from the bigger cities, like you mentioned, but then it starts going, you know, then there's feedback loops, you know, and like Anthony, let's take Anthony's gang history, for example, that emanates directly, as far as, you know, my studies concern, from Juarez, from Western Juarez, from Anapra, and some of its earliest groups in the 60s and stuff were known groups in Juarez. And they, you know, families reestablished on this side and kept those traditions of those groups. So there's a long tradition there, and then the groups morph and they form different chapters in different cities across the region. And yeah, as families move, so does the gang subculture move with them, and they form little satellite groups and connections. And so, yeah, those are the implications, you know.
We're visiting with Professor Mike Tapia. Dr. Tapia is a professor of criminology at New Mexico State University. We're discussing the last 100 years in gang history in the El Paso Juarez borderland. Tell us a little bit about, this is something that we may have a misconception about as well, and that is tagging. We're driving down the street, we'll see a building or a billboard that has been tagged, and sometimes people don't understand, well, what does it say? What, if they're going to tag something, why don't they put something legible? Or they'll wonder, how in the heck did these kids get up on that billboard in the middle of the freeway?
Right, that's an urban subculture unto its own. And the assumption is that the kids that do, the taggers that do this stuff, are gang involved. And that could be true. Of course, there's a great amount of overlap between the two subcultures, but not necessarily so. You know, there are some kids that are just exclusively focused on their, you know, they consider it an art form. And the more daring, you know, the feat in terms of getting your exposure on a really high billboard or a super dangerous place that it would seem dangerous to have gotten up there and stuff, then that even more street cred goes to that kid, you know, whose tag is up there visible for all to see. So, yeah, there are all these little manifestations of the that are on the margins of the hardcore gang subculture in the city, you know, and that's true of every place in the U.S. And so you have things like party crews, you know, that have a lot, you know, they throw parties, you know, keg parties and stuff like that, and then they do overlap. They kind of intermingle with gang populations at those places and those events and stuff. And so, yeah, I mean, there's all these networks, you know, of youth going across. But, you know, what are inner city kids supposed to do, right? If you think about gangs and all this, you know, delinquent subculture as a social problem, well, the fewer things that we have for them to do that are like, you know, mainstream pro-social activities, and we're not channeling poor inner city kids into those things, then they're going to make their own fun, right? And they're going to find some things to entertain themselves. So in my mind, that's what it's all about.
What about Ciudad Juarez? Is that kind of like the center of it all, or how does that work?
Yeah, that's right. That's like the big question in the book. Kind of one of the underlying themes is, are Juarez and El Paso truly sister cities? And of course, in many ways they are, and in many ways they aren't. And so when you look at it through a kind of a criminological lens, well, same thing, you know, the same conclusion, they are and they aren't sister cities. Juarez's violence, you know, gang and drug attributed type violence is astronomical in terms of the body count. You know, we're approaching 1,500 murders in Juarez this year. For a city of its size, that is unheard of. There's no American city that really rivals that level. Some come close, New Orleans and others, but not, no. It's one of the most dangerous places in the world, period. And that's not hyperbole. That's not an exaggeration. And El Paso, on the other hand, you know, is not. You know, we've already, you know, stated what it is in terms of its public safety. Yet, there are networks. You know, there are delinquent and criminal networks that cross the border. You know, Homeland Security agents and other federal agents are trying to, you know, cut that off. But it's something that is easier said than done and almost an impractical goal, you know, to some folks, because, you know, human, family, commerce networks are stronger than, you know, this man-made, you know, artificial border. So, yeah, it's a super interesting question, you know, about how connected they are and all that stuff.
So, Mike, what is happening now? We talked about the history, the last 100 years. You talked about social media, what's going on in Juarez right now. And people might ask, okay, what is the future of gangs?
So one of the most basic contributions that I claim this book makes is just to preserve the history of that subculture. Because after 100 years, it seems really to be fading or morphing into something that we haven't seen before. Or, you know, just taking a different form, more underground, more high-tech in terms of the communication amongst underworld types or even just delinquent kids. There's no longer this public manifestation of the subculture. You know, the territorial claims in the neighborhoods for turf and stuff like that, that seems to have almost completely gone by the wayside and like become extinct. So today's gangs are just, they look and feel different. It's more about making money, you know. So you see groups that are traditional rivals or supposed to, you know, historically are rivals, Bloods and Crips, right? You know, the kind of quintessential example there. Hanging out, sporting their colors, you know, and gang detectives are like scratching their heads, you know, when they're pulling them over saying, wow, like, what's going on here? It's becoming post-racial, you know. The gangs are, like, there's a certain type of gang in Texas called tangos, right? And they're sort of like a hybrid between prison or jail and street gangs. You know, these are like ages 17 to 25 youth. And it seems like they're into making money, and they organize. You know, there's like a geographic tribalism. You know, there's a tango from San Antonio. Every major city has its tango, and then including El Paso. They're called Chuco Tango. And so these groups, they recruit. They're not strictly Chicanos, you know. A lot of times they recruit, and this is more true of, like, especially like Dallas, Houston, San Antonio. They'll recruit white kids. They'll recruit black kids, you know, and kids with that are racially and ethnically mixed. And they do it in the name of power and numbers because they have to kind of stand up to traditional prison gangs in the incarceral setting. And then, you know, they come out here and they do stuff. So things are really, yeah, they're becoming even more interesting by the day. So, you know, Daniel Burunda and some of the other, you know, crime beat writers, they know this, you know, they've seen those patterns. And so, yeah, you could see in the later chapters, I'll write about stuff like that. So, yeah, it's be interesting to see how this all develops eventually.
Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us. Before we leave, if you wouldn't mind giving us a web address or a link to where people can find out more about your research.
Thanks, Louis. And, you know, we've had a bunch of signings at Barnes & Noble's and stuff. So anyone just, you know, wanting to pick up a copy and visit a store and the old traditional shopping way can hit, you know, Barnes & Noble's like Mesilla Valley Mall or at the Fountains is carrying it. I have a book signing, other ones in Las Cruces. So you could look for those, and but you can always just Google it and find it on Amazon, and yeah, so order it that way.
Mike, thank you so much for being with us.
Louis, thanks for having me on the show. It was great.
We've been visiting with Professor Mike Tapia. Mike has written the book, Gangs of the El Paso Juarez Borderland. The Weekend is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Our thanks to our engineer and producer, Sam Cassiano. You've been tuned to The Weekend. I'm Louis Sainz.